You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by FData, the Financial Data and Technology Association, advocating for open finance across North America and around the world. At its heart, open banking is a simple idea. Your money, your data, your choice. A promise that the digital age would finally hand us the keys to our own financial lives. Progress has clearly been made. Open banking efforts have now begun in over 100 countries. But make no mistake, every market that has tried to build open banking has discovered the same uncomfortable truth. This is hard. Resistance from incumbents, confusion over rules, years and years just to get properly started. Nowhere has the fight for open banking been more contested, more political, more uncertain than in the world's largest economy, the United States. America's turbulent experience provides a mirror, reflecting back at every open banking practitioner around the globe, shining a light on the questions they all have to answer for themselves. Do you side with banks or fintechs? What do you regulate and what do you leave to the market? How do you create technical standards? What are your actual goals? And what exactly does it mean to give people control over their data? None of these questions have easy answers. Those building open banking wrestle with them every day. Questions about commercial incentive structures, infrastructure cost recovery, and ecosystem-wide trust. Yet, beneath the surface lies the deepest question of all. Who controls your data? Not just your financial data, all of it. When you start pulling at that thread, it leads somewhere bigger, somewhere beyond open banking. On this episode, recorded live at FinTech NerdCon in Miami late last year, I speak to someone who has built a career by being the most curious person in fintech. Someone whose sharp insights have become essential reading for tens of thousands of people trying to make sense of this exact moment. On Mr. Open Banking, live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from Miami at the first ever edition of FinTech NerdCon. For this session, I am honored to be joined by someone who lives at the very center of the FinTech universe. Alex Johnson is a writer, podcaster, researcher and consultant, most widely known as the founder and author of FinTech Takes, one of the most well-respected newsletters in the industry, read religiously by over 40,000 subscribers. Known for his sharp insights, strong opinions, and engaging commentary, Alex has earned his place as a trusted voice throughout the global financial ecosystem as he follows his aspiration to be the most curious person in FinTech. Alex, thank you for joining me.
Oh gosh, thanks for having me. It's my honor.
In your work, you cover a wide variety of topics, but as you might expect, our conversation is going to revolve around open banking. So let's jump in with both feet. My first question is about the state of open banking in the US. The Personal Financial Data Rights Rule, commonly known as Section 1033, was officially finalized in October 2024, marking the first time the U.S. has attempted to regulate open banking. Then, the roller coaster began. 1033 was challenged in court the day of its release, declared unlawful in May by the CFPB themselves, who then reversed course in July, deciding that they would rewrite the rule instead.
Yep.
As of October 29th, it currently sits under court injunction, with all enforcement suspended. My question is, what is actually happening? Is this just an unfortunate bout of regulatory chaos, or is this a symptom of something deeper?
Well, that's a good question. As you illustrated in your timeline there, I think the core issue with open banking in the U.S. is that the CFPB doesn't really have a unified perspective on the policy question. Right. So Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act is very short, right? It's not that long. It's fairly vague. It creates some level of right for consumers to access and share their financial data. But it's really not specific in terms of, is it just consumers who can share their data? Is it third parties acting on behalf of consumers? What data can consumers share? How broad does that remit go? Are the data providers that are sharing the data to the consumer at their direction able to be reimbursed for that cost? Are they able to charge fees? Are they able to restrict access to the data if they think that there's some fraud or risk associated with it? So there's no specificity around that, right? And the previous version of the CFPB under the Biden administration had a very specific view on what Section 1033 meant, what Section 1033 authorized them to do, and they wrote a rule based on their reading of it, right? Well, now we have the second Trump administration. We have Russ Vogt, who is, I think, less of a CFPB director and more of like a performance artist trying to sort of demonstrate what it looks like when you just strip away all federal bureaucracy. I don't think he has any particularly strong feelings one way or the other on open banking. But he does sort of want to see everything that the Biden era CFPB do kind of unravel and be pulled apart, right? And so the default approach when the Trump administration first was getting going was, let's just sort of get rid of everything that the last administration did, including open banking. The problem with that is, and this is the part of the story that you didn't mention, but is kind of the undercurrent that sits under it, is if you get rid of the rule, and more importantly, if you get rid of the cop on the beat who is sort of monitoring the market's behavior, well, then everyone in the market is going to sort of try to do what they want to do on this issue. And of course, the bank that has the most sort of influence and power to shape the market absent any rules is JP Morgan Chase. And when the CFPB reversed course all of a sudden and said, no, wait, we don't want to throw out the rule. We want to rewrite it instead. That coincidentally happened very, very shortly after Chase went to all the data aggregators and said, hey, you need to pay us these fees, right? And so to me, what we're seeing play out in the market is a form of regulatory chaos or uncertainty that is caused when the agency in charge of setting the rules and enforcing market behavior doesn't have a strong opinion one way or the other as to what those rules should be, right? And so one day they're talking to Chase or some of the other big banks, and they sort of are like, oh no, you're right, we should throw out the rule, this is silly, of course you should be able to charge for the data. And then the next day, someone in the crypto lobby calls the White House, and suddenly the CFPB has a completely different opinion on how open banking should work, and oh no, suddenly now we need to revamp the rule. And so it feels a little bit like day to day, depending on who has the ear of the White House and then how that filters down to Russ Vogt and the CFPB, you're getting different postures from the Bureau around open banking. There's just no consistency anymore.
You mentioned JP Morgan charging for access. So let's go there.
Yeah.
Back in July of this year, Bloomberg reported that JP Morgan Chase sent pricing sheets to data aggregators,
yeah,
announcing it would charge fees, as you said, for accessing customers' banking data, in clear violation, it's worth noting, of 1033.
Yes.
You called this a, quote, tectonic move that threatened the industry's business model. Some called the fees extortion and warned that they would halt innovation.
Sure.
Others claimed the banks had to recover infrastructure costs, infrastructure which, to date, fintechs had been using for free.
Sure.
Fast forward to September, and Plaid became the first major aggregator to sign a paid agreement with JPMC. And by November this month, those deals now extend to most other aggregators, including Yodlee, Morningstar, and Akoya.
Yeah.
From your perspective, is this precedent a good thing or a bad thing? Should charging fees for customer data access be allowed or forbidden?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. So I see both sides of the argument. I think that the initial reaction you saw when Chase came out with their proposed fees was partially due to the fact that aggregators didn't want to pay fees. And, you know, any business that gets its raw materials for free would not want to suddenly start paying for its raw materials. So that's an understandable reaction. But I think the larger objection to the Chase pricing proposal had more to do with the amount. And I heard various sort of explanations ranging from this amount, if we just paid Chase what they're asking for us, would equal the entirety of our revenue for the year, to this amount, if we paid Chase, would equal the entirety of the revenue we've ever made as a company, right?
You heard figures like 1,000% of the value of the transaction.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think part of the initial reaction from data aggregators and fintechs wasn't so much to the notion of fees, which, as you said, like, there's an argument to be made that it's reasonable that fees be assessed. The argument was they are trying to drive our business into the ground because they don't like it, right? And so as Plaid has been negotiating, and I suppose you could view this as just a negotiating strategy, right? You go to a car dealership, you want to buy a BMW, they're like, yeah, that's going to cost, you know, $240,000. And you go, how about $1, right? Like, that's not a very serious negotiating posture, but it would be a negotiating strategy. It's similar here, right? Where it's like, hey, we would like to charge you the amount of money that you made in revenue the entire year. And you go, well, that's not workable for us. Okay, well, what's your counteroffer? Well, clearly, Plaid and JPMorgan Chase got to a place where the counteroffer was acceptable. So they signed that deal. There's since been similar deals that Chase has struck with other providers. Akoya was not a surprise since Chase owns Akoya partially. And so different data aggregators have sort of different postures on this. But in general, to get to your question, I actually don't think it's unreasonable for a small fee to be paid. And the main reason I think that is, if you go to other markets around the world, there's very few actually that don't have a fee component built into them, right? Australia is one of the few mature markets that doesn't have a fee. And even they are kind of reassessing, maybe should we change that? And I think what that tells us is, normatively, if you want open banking to work well in a market, you sort of need the companies that have the data to not just dedicate the rest of their lives to rubbing sand in the gears of the machine you're trying to build. Banks can be extraordinarily petty about this if they want to be. I heard a story about a data aggregator that was working with a large bank that didn't really like open banking, and they had a data access agreement in place. And the data access agreement allowed for X amount of downtime per year to maintain the API. And the theory was, oh, that'll just be kind of spread out throughout the year. But they didn't put that detail in the contract. And as such, the bank scheduled all of its downtime for Super Bowl Sunday, which was their biggest day of the year, right? So banks can do stuff like that if they want to. And one of the lessons I've taken away from this entire drama around open banking is people are very in their feelings about this, right? Like, they're not always necessarily making rational business decisions. They are making emotional decisions. And if you piss off data providers and they feel like they just need to rub sand in the gears of this machine and stop it at all costs, even beyond what's rational from a business perspective, they will do that, and it will degrade the quality of the ecosystem. So I kind of come down on the perspective of a small fee for cost recovery that is reasonable is something that would probably make the ecosystem work better. And the most important point is it wouldn't really kill any of the business models for the fintech companies that rely on this data, right? I would say pay by bank is probably the one that is the hardest because the margins are the smallest. But like, I talk to fintech companies that use open banking data for cash flow underwriting, and all of them were like, look, a little increase in cost doesn't really change anything for us. we're happy to continue to pay it. We'll use it. It doesn't really change our business that much. And I actually think most open banking stuff is like that. Most applications, a little increase in costs that Plaid's saying they're not going to pass the costs on right away, but eventually they will. A little increase in costs is not going to end the world for most providers, assuming it's reasonable. And that to me is where regulators might need to step back in, because absent regulators, you know, Plaid had the leverage to go back to Chase and negotiate a good deal. Not every fintech company is going to have that leverage. Not every small data aggregator is going to have that same leverage. In fact, no one but Plaid has that leverage. And that's the thing I worry about, is creating sort of a two-tiered system where Chase and Plaid can work out one deal, but then Chase can go, nope, it's our way or the highway to a small data aggregator, or vice versa. Plaid can go, no, it's our way or the highway to a small bank that doesn't have the leverage. And that's not a well-constructed market. And that's where I think we need regulation.
You briefly mentioned other markets.
Yeah.
Looking at the rest of the world, it's pretty clear that the U.S. is lagging when it comes to regulated open banking and the enforced standardization that goes with it.
Yeah.
The U.K. has been live since 2018. Brazil scaled up both their Pix payment rail and open banking at the same time in 2021. And even Canada just announced an accelerated timeline targeting 2026. When you consider these other markets, have they done anything right that the U.S. could learn from? Or is the U.S. just too different?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think the U.S. is too different. I remember talking one time to a central banker who worked for the central bank in Brazil, right? And they were explaining how they got Pix started and how they grew so much. And I was asking, like, how are you doing this? Because in the U.S., faster payments is just like moving glacially slowly, and banks won't adopt it. Or if they adopt FedNow, they'll just adopt it for receive but not send. Like, what the hell? Like, why is this taking so long? And the central banker looked at me and he's like, we're their regulator. We just tell them what to do and they do it. And I was like, yeah, that's not how it works in the U.S. And he was so confused that that's not how it works in the U.S. But the relationship between federal regulators, state regulators, banks, non-banks, in the U.S., it is just enormously complicated. There's a lot of money and a lot of lobbying that sort of keeps the sort of chaotic status quo the way it is. And I think it's really hard through that environment to push through a more tough approach to regulating open banking in the U.S. It doesn't help that the statute in Dodd-Frank is incredibly vague. And it also doesn't help that now we have two Supreme Court precedents, the end of the Chevron defense through Loper-Bright and then the Corner Post decision. And those two Supreme Court decisions, not to get all lawyerly for a second, but essentially they allow industry to sue over any regulatory rule forever in perpetuity if there's any vagueness in the original statute at all. And what that practically means is there's no way that we will ever have an open banking rule in this country that there's not a lawsuit being filed over. It will just happen in perpetuity forever, which is great for lawyers and bad for everyone else. But because that's the system we have in the U.S. and those are the dynamics at play, we're going to have market-driven open banking. We already have a very robust market-driven open banking system. But I don't think we're ever going to get to the strong regulated open banking system that other markets have, because we are different and not in a good way.
Let's talk about standards. One consistent thread across successful open banking implementations is clear technical standards.
Yeah.
Although back in January, the U.S. did anoint FDX, the Financial Data Exchange, as a standards body, given the turmoil around 1033, that status is unclear.
Yeah.
How critical is this gap? Does a private, market-led nonprofit like FDX even need the regulator's blessing to succeed? And more generally, what is the role of industry standards, regulated or otherwise, in driving financial innovation?
Yeah, I was just having this conversation with a bunch of regulators and policy folks in DC this week. We are going to need standards. We absolutely are going to need private industry standards, because they are going to fill in the gaps that regulators either can't or won't fill in themselves, right? And regulators tend to not want to be overly prescriptive. You know, no one wants regulators writing like technical specs, right? That's not what regulators are good at. if you write it into a regulation, then anytime it changes, it has to go back through the Administrative Procedures Act process in order to update it. So you don't want things besides like the broad principles enshrined in regulation. You want it ideally to be handled through standards. And I would say even things in the original open banking rule that's now being revised, you know, I asked Director Chopra at the CFPB under Biden this question on stage. I was like, hey, so how are you going to handle something like liability, right? Which really isn't governed by the existing rule. And his answer was the market will figure that out, right? They figured it out for card payments. We have Nacha. We have like these private organizations that set industry rules. We will have that in open banking as well. And I think in general, that's right. I think your point about regulation maybe stepping back from standards is an important one, because the challenge with regulators not playing a role in the standard setting process at all is who runs FTX? Who has influence in FTX? Regulators, and I will say, like under the Biden administration, they were very tough with FTX about, hey, we don't like the way your organization is structured. We don't like who sits on these different steering committees. We want to see true, balanced, neutral standard setting organization before we bless them.
In fact, they published their criteria for a standard setting body middle of last year, and FTX jumped through a lot of hoops to meet those criteria.
They did, right. And absent the CFPB caring about standards, you're going to get private industry standards, but they may end up being standards that are set by the folks that have the most influence, which won't necessarily reflect what's best for a well-functioning market. And that's the part I worry about. I absolutely think we're going to get standards. FTX is going to continue to exist from a technical standard perspective. I think they're going to get into risk management and compliance questions and liability. I think there's going to be other organizations that step into that fray as well. But the challenge is going to be, how are those organizations governed? And I don't think Russ Vogt cares about that.
Do you think this lack of strong regulatory enforcement is a symptom of this uniquely American brand of capitalism?
Yes, I do. I think we tend to sort of just let the strongest survive, unfortunately. And it's not always good for innovation. It's not always good for creating a level playing field. But I think in general, the strongest kind of survive. Now, I will say the interesting thing with this open banking fight has been who the strongest is looks different than it used to be. I think Chase was really surprised to find out how much lobbying power Tyler Winklevoss has with this White House. He can tweet and he can make stuff happen. And I think Chase is used to fighting from a lobbying and an influence perspective in a very different world. So the rules of the game change, and that does allow other providers or other interests to get a seat at the table. But it's far from the objective, unbiased, what should a healthy market look like perspective, which I think was one of the original goals that the CFPB had, was we want to try to create a competitive market that works well for consumers. And I think we are probably unlikely to get back to that, even, you know, in a future where we have a Democratic administration and the CFPB kind of roars back to life. You know, caring about a competitive market is kind of a like technocratic sort of almost neutral political position. It's not especially conservative. It's not especially progressive. It's kind of in the middle. And I just think politically, we're not in a place where we're ever going to arrive at that middle zone. So that's, to me, the tragedy of all of this is we sort of missed our window to get a good rule in place that everyone could just kind of live with and move on from. We missed the window for that.
Let's switch to a subject that frankly could not be any more popular. AI.
Yeah. Everybody drink.
There's little question that AI has become the narrative driver of 2025 and years prior. You and your peers have written extensively about agentic finance and agentic commerce. Just this morning on stage, Simon Taylor said, quote, "Agents at the checkout are building the internet's new trust layer," end quote. Let's explore that. What happens when you pair AI-driven agents on one side with open banking on the other?
Yeah, that is the question. So it's interesting because a lot of the stuff that's happening in AI and agentic AI rhymes with all of the fights we've been having around open banking, right? AI companies need data to train their models. So they'll go scrape the entire internet to get all of that data. Well, screen scraping, where have I heard that before? What does that look like? How do we stop that? What do the fights over screen scraping look like? We've just spent the last 15 years figuring that out in the U.S. around open banking. We're going to go through that again with AI labs versus other providers, right? Another example is AI agents acting on behalf of customers. This is the equivalent of not read access, but write access in open banking. Should you be able to authorize a third party to do something on your behalf? What does that authorization look like? Does the provider on the other side have the ability to block an agent operating on behalf of a customer? You know, we saw Amazon get into a dispute with Perplexity over this exact question, right? Amazon argues that Perplexity is violating its terms of service. Perplexity argues that Amazon's customers authorized it to act on their behalf. Who's right? How does that work? So I think a lot of things that we've been wrestling with in open banking are going to get magnified tremendously once we have these autonomous agents acting on consumers' behalf, because you need to have data for agents to be able to make decisions or take actions, right? So to me, this is going to be a fight that we're going to have. And the problem, I think, for regulators or for people who want the market to work in a somewhat rational way is if you thought that Chase and Plaid were difficult to deal with on these questions and difficult to get to some point of agreement, try bringing OpenAI into that conversation. See how that goes, right? OpenAI has no interest in playing nicely with anyone else. They're worth $100 trillion or whatever they're worth now. They don't need to play this same game. They can just bulldoze through any of these walls. And so we're going to see a lot of these fights not only continue, but accelerate thanks to AI. I also think the other thing that's interesting with AI is fairly soon we are going to have on-device AI agents that can do whatever we want, right? And so if you're a bank and you say, hey, we don't like this data aggregator, we're going to block screen scraping, whatever, like screen scraping and the ability to deal with it technically, that is just something that used to exist in a different world. Now it's incredibly easy for a consumer to spin up their own screen scraper on demand to scrape their data, and there is no way to block it or stop it. It's essentially the DDoS equivalent in open banking, right? Like, so if you don't figure out a way to harness AI and have them go through gates, have them go through APIs, have them integrate with model context protocols, if you don't figure out the infrastructure for this, AI and the AI labs are absolutely just going to overwhelm you. And they're not going to care, and regulators aren't going to be able to stop them. And so I think if you were worried about any of this stuff as a bank or as a fintech company, as a data aggregator, AI just makes all of it 1,000 times more complex.
All of this, Section 1033 chaos, JPMC charging for data access,
yeah,
the trust implications and necessary infrastructure that agentic AI demands, seems to point to a fundamental question that goes well beyond finance. The question of data rights.
Yeah.
Not just for financial data, but for all data. Countries like Australia have already enshrined a generalized data right into law.
Yep.
Europe and Canada are moving to do the same. Even the U.S. regulation, beleaguered as it may be, includes the words data rights.
Yeah.
Right there in the name.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, should the U.S. move towards generalized data rights? And if so, what should they be? And if I may, in keeping with the show's gaming theme, bonus points,
yeah,
if you can tie this back to AI.
Ooh, good question. All right, so I think that we absolutely need a generalized approach to regulating data and creating some type of right for consumers around data. I just think that everything I outlined with AI and with the way that AI works, and it's going to make all these problems just way more difficult to deal with, is going to point us towards a future where essentially we are going to need some generalized form of this. To be totally honest with you, I don't really think the CFPB is the right organization, even in a fully staffed capacity, to deal with general data rights. We saw under the last administration, Director Chopra sort of tried to swim a little outside of his lane because he was one of the only people kind of looking at these larger questions of like, well, what do we do with AI? What do we do with kind of consumer data rights specifically? I remember asking him about some questions around like secondary data use in open banking, right? What else can you use this data for? And the Bureau took a very hardline stance on secondary data. And part of the reason they did that, according to him, was well, we don't have a national privacy law in this country, right? We don't have anything that really stops companies from doing these, so we have to enact it narrowly through open banking for the part that we have control over. The better answer is to stand up a new regulatory agency that just focuses on data, right? I had Jane Barrett from MX at an event that I hosted recently, and she was saying that, and she's absolutely right about this, data has become an off-balance sheet asset for the largest companies in the world, right? And what she meant was, unlike everything else that we account for and regulate that companies have as assets or liabilities, data is just this thing that's enormously valuable, but it sits off book. We don't value it. We don't think about it. There's been academic literature written about, like, hey, should these two companies be allowed to merge? Well, one of the most important questions about M&A and antitrust is, are they going after a pot of data that we don't want them to have? Antitrust regulators don't look at that. They don't look at data as an asset that they should factor into their calculations. And so I think we need a complete revamping of how we think about, value, and regulate data broadly beyond open banking. And the things we've seen with open banking, and now the things we're seeing with AI, there's your AI tie, those things need to essentially embark us upon a broader conversation on how we regulate data. I mean, just to give you one test case for the future that's going to be really interesting. Does a consumer have the right to take their AI training data, their personal memory and history with ChatGPT, and take it over to Claude? I think the answer to that question is yes, but I challenge anyone to find any statute or law that says the same thing. It doesn't exist. We need new laws and new regulations because that's a question people are going to care about in the not too distant future.
You don't have to go to AI. I presume your answer would be the same if you were talking about moving your search history from Google or your social graph from Meta, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only one of these that we have, the only one that we've solved, which is so annoying, is you can port your phone number over from Verizon to AT&T, right? Great. And actually, even that small little silly example is a funny one because once we did that, guess what happened? AT&T Verizon had to be so much more aggressive in trying to keep our business and retain us as customers. Like, improvements in pricing, in service, in rewards all went up when we forced providers to compete more with each other. And at the heart of open banking and everything that the last CFPB was trying to do was really this idea that if we force companies to compete on a more level playing field and consumers can choose where they want to go, they may not, but if they have the choice and the ability to do that, it will force companies to compete harder for them. And that's to the benefit of the market and the customer.
To compete on genuine innovation rather than artificial moats.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, inertia is such a powerful force in banking, right? No one wants to switch their banking. And quite frankly, this goes back to your AI question. Even something like, are you getting screwed by your current provider in terms of your interest rate, right? This happened to me. I had a high-yield savings account that was not a high-yield savings account because I opened it 6 years ago. I just assumed in my brain, not thinking about it because I'm busy, oh, I'm sure they've raised my interest rate over time. It's probably not the maximum, but like it's probably, I mean, I think the high at the time was like 6%. Maybe it's like, you know, 4, 3.5. It was 0.5. It had not moved an inch in the 6 years since I opened that account. Even though I was a loyal customer, I would love to have an AI agent empowered by open banking that could just tap me on the shoulder and go, hey, by the way, your bank hates you. You should think about that. And oh, by the way, if you want to move, here's a different provider that's willing to offer you something. And oh, if you want to authorize it, we can just go open the account and move the money for you. That's amazing for customers. It is horrible for banks. It is horrible for net interest margin. It's horrible for banks' business models. But my attitude with all those kind of things is we will figure out other ways for banks to be stable. We will figure out other ways for banks to exist. We will figure out other ways for our system to work. The answer should never be, oh, we should hold customers hostage because we need to protect net interest margin. Like, that's just a terrible, terrible answer.
For banks, for search engines, for social media companies,
totally.
For AI providers. To close, let's transport ourselves into that new world.
Okay.
Where people have a right to access their data, all their data, and share it with whomever they choose to their benefit. All based on a dependable trust framework underpinned by legislated data rights. In that world.
That distant, distant world out there in 3,000 years from now. Yeah.
FinTech NerdCon 3000. In that world, what role do technology providers play? What role do regulators play? Mm. And what role do banks play?
Wow, that's a good question. So in that world, regulators are strong and powerful and empowered by legislation. So the regulators of today will not recognize that world. I will say that first. Technology companies, I think, become more utilities, right? And I think this is actually a really interesting question. Technology companies have had the benefit of, as you illustrated with Google and with Meta and whatever, they've had the ability to, again, treat data as this off-balance sheet asset that they can use to lock customers into ecosystems without actually really having to earn someone's loyalty. Google's a great example. Google sucks today compared to how it used to be. Like, it used to be this magical experience, and it's just terrible and overburdened with ads. And it would have been nice if other search engines could have displaced it, but there was just no ability to move your search history or to do anything. They just had such a strong moat, even as they kind of slowly degraded their product over time. Same thing applies to social media. Twitter is horrific, but I kind of can't leave, but I really want to. So I think that technology companies over time will probably shift to being more like utility or infrastructure providers. And a lot more of the value will accrue to the companies that build products. And that could be a technology company that builds the end user product. It could be a bank that builds financial products. Could be a merchant that builds these products. But in all of those cases, the products are the thing that are going to keep people connected. And as soon as the product degrades, you just have to make different choices, I think, if you're a company, because you know the underlying assumption is if we mess up the product, if our, you know, loyalty scores go down by this much, people will flee in a way they never have before. And so I think it'll keep companies and product managers much more attuned to making sure the products are great. And quite frankly, I think in this future, obviously AI will factor into this future quite a bit. You know, you're going to have AI agents that are constantly asking you as a user, hey, I found a better, cheaper product. Do you want to switch? It's cheaper. It has slightly better reviews, whatever the qualitative factors are or quantitative factors. And qualitatively, what you're going to need as a brand or a company is for the user to overpower the AI's recommendation and go, even though it's 50 basis points cheaper, and even though there's zero friction from moving me from this provider to this provider, I'm not going to because I like the person I talked to at that company. I like the way this product makes me feel. I like the fact that they sponsor my son's T-ball game. Whatever. Whatever the reason is, you're going to need a reason that's not dollars and cents to keep customers. And I think that's a great world. I think that's a world where products are better, customer service is better, the things we all care about and want the market to prioritize will be better. And so to me, that last layer of the stack is where a lot of the value will accrue, but you'll have to fight to keep that value in a way that I don't always see today.
You touched on the product side. Why don't you close us out
Sure.
by spending a minute talking about the identity and trust side?
Yeah.
Again, for technology providers, regulators, and banks, how do you see them participating in enforcing trust?
So what's interesting is in this future state that I think we eventually want to get to, I think identity and trust will be, to a degree, kind of built into the system, right? Like, we don't have good digital identity today. It doesn't work. It's fractured. It's very, very nascent. But there's no real technical reason we can't have better identity and trust at an infrastructure layer. And I think eventually we will. Apple's working on this. Clear's working on this. There's a bunch that are working on this. The challenge is, what do you do with that level of trust? When trust is no longer a moat where you can keep people trapped, the question is not, do I know who this person is? Have I built up some level of trust with them? The question is, what do you do with that, right? I mean, just to give one example, I find it astonishing that customer loyalty and longevity never factors into companies' decisions at all, right? Like, I don't get a better interest rate because I've been with my bank for 20 years. I don't know why. I should, but I don't. And so to me, there's going to be a set of business decisions that get made on what we do with the relationships we have and the trust we've built, knowing that trust and knowing the customer at a baseline level, that's going to go away. But the things that a company can get to know about a customer over time, that stuff that is more in the eye of the beholder almost, like they needed to develop a more nuanced way of looking at me, Alex, as a customer and going, do we value Alex or not? And if they don't, that's totally fine. And I'll stay as long as I want. And as soon as I find someone else to pitch me something better, that's when I'll go do that. But on the other hand, if they view me as a valuable customer, as like the exact core customer that they want, and they're constantly updating their profile and their understanding of me as an outstanding customer, what I hope is they will take action to keep me. And they'll do it proactively, right? Going back to my bank example, they won't let my high yield savings account languish at a very low interest rate because they will be so terrified by the possibility that I will check or my AI agent will check that they will proactively be keeping it closer to the rate of interest rate increases. And they'll explain why and they'll tell me that they value me as a customer. We don't get any of that today in financial services, but I don't think there's any reason that we couldn't, especially if some of these other things that we've been talking about come to pass.
Not trust like a passport, trust like a friend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the trust as a passport thing is going to become commoditized at some point. Like, it's just going to. Trust as a friend is something that is harder to scale. It's harder to make kind of a dollars and cents business case around. I think it's something McKinsey will struggle to articulate, but it is very valuable. We all have relationships like this, not just between friends, not personal relationships, business relationships that we think of in emotional terms. We're going to have more of those in the future.
Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. This was great.
Just like everywhere else, America is doing its best to answer the difficult questions that come with open banking. And just like everywhere else, its answers are messy, contentious, and imperfect. That in itself is the lesson. Open banking was never going to look the same everywhere. It bends and flexes to fit the banking system, the political structure, the very culture of the place it lands. Finding that fit takes time. Despite the differences, some answers are universal. Shared standards that everyone can build on, but that no one owns. Governance that keeps power balanced and the market healthy. And, above all, a basic right for people to control their own data. As technology advances, the need to learn these lessons becomes more and more urgent. Artificial intelligence being Exhibit A. As Alex says, the banking industry spent decades fighting over screen scraping and delegated trust. If we're not careful, we will have to fight that battle all over again. This time, against much bigger opponents. Which is precisely why this moment matters. As AI introduces autonomous agents into our lives, they are going to demand our trust. Trust which today, many are still unwilling to give. Open banking has been building trust for over a decade, based on real technology, backed by real laws. The infrastructure behind it, the APIs, the consent flows, the standards, provides the trust that AI so desperately needs to achieve its full potential. These challenges do not remain confined to banking. The battle for data ownership, data mobility, and ultimately data rights is coming for every industry. Not just silos of private data like healthcare and telecom, but the realms of big tech, search, social, commerce, and yes, even AI. When switching providers of all stripes becomes as easy as porting a phone number, companies everywhere will have to compete better, will have to be better, keenly aware that you can easily walk away, leading to better products, better services, better lives, all because you, not some distant giant platform, hold the keys to your information. That is the future open banking is trying to build. One messy, hard-fought answer at a time.
Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time.
This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by FData, the Financial Data and Technology Association, advocating for open finance across North America and around the world. To learn more, join FData's Global Open Finance Summit and visit fdata.global.